Chapter 4. The westering sun shining in on his face woke Shevik as the dirigible, clearing the last high pass of the Ne Thera, turned due south. He had slept most of the day, the third of the long journey. The night of the farewell party was half a world behind him. He yawned and rubbed his eyes and shook his head, trying to shake the deep rumble of the dirigible engine out of his ears. And then came wide awake, realizing that the journey was nearly over, that they must be coming close to Avani. He pressed his face to the dusty window, and sure enough, down there between the two low rusty ridges was a great walled field, the port. He gazed eagerly, trying to see if there was a spaceship on the pad. Despicable as Urus was, still, it was another world. He wanted to see a ship from another world. A voyager across the dry and terrible abyss, a thing made by alien hands. But there was no ship in the port. The freighters from Urus came in only 8 times a year and stayed just long enough to load and unload. They were not welcome visitors. Indeed, they were, to some Anaresti, a perpetually renewed humiliation. They brought fossil oils and petroleum products, certain delicate machine parts and electronic components that Anaresti manufacturing was not geared to supply, and often a new strain of fruit tree or grain for testing. They took back to Urus a full load of mercury, copper, aluminum, uranium, tin, and gold. It was, for them, a very good bargain. The division of their cargoes 8 times a year was the most prestigious function of the Erasti Council of World Governments, and the major event of the Erasti World Stock Market. In fact, the free world of Anaris was a mining colony of Urus. The fact galled. Every generation, every year, in the PDC debates of Avani, fierce protests were made. Why do we continue these profiteering business transactions with war-making proprietarians? And cooler heads always gave the same answer. It would cost the Erasti more to dig the ores themselves. Therefore, they don't invade us. But if we broke the trade agreement, they would use force. It is hard, however, for people who have never paid money for anything to understand the psychology of cost, the argument of the marketplace. 7 generations of peace had not brought trust. Therefore, the work posting called defense never had to call for volunteers. Most defense work was so boring that it was not called work in Previk, which used the same word for work and play, but klegich, drudgery. Defense workers manned the 12 old interplanetary ships, keeping them repaired and in orbit as a guard network. Maintained radar and radio telescopic scans in lonesome places. Did dull duty at the port, and yet they always had a waiting list. However pragmatic the morality a young Anaresti absorbed, yet life overflowed in him, demanding altruism, self-sacrifice, scope for the absolute gesture. Loneliness, watchfulness, danger, spaceships. They offered the lure of romance. It was pure romance that kept Shevik flattening his nose against the window until the vacant port had dropped away behind the dirigible. And that left him disappointed, because he had not seen a grubby ore freighter on the pad. He yawned again and stretched, and then looked out ahead to see what was to be seen. The dirigible was clearing the last low ridge of the Ne Thera. Before it, stretching out southward from the mountain's arms, brilliant in the afternoon sunlight, lay a great sloping bay of green. He looked at it with wonder, as his ancestors 6,000 years ago had looked at it. In the 3rd millennium on Urus, the astronomer priests of Serdono and Dune had watched the seasons change the tawny brightness of the other world, and had given mystical names to the plains and ranges and sun-reflecting seas. One region that grew green before all others in the Lunar New Year, they called Ans Hus, the Garden of Mind, the Eden of Anaris. In later millennia, telescopes had proved them to be quite correct. An's hus was indeed the most favored spot on Anaris, and the first manned ship to the moon had come down there in the green place between the mountains and the sea. But the Eden of Anaris proved to be dry, cold, and windy, and the rest of the planet was worse. Life there had not evolved higher than fish and flowerless plants. The air was thin, like the air of Urus at a very high altitude. The sun burned, the wind froze, the dust choked. For 200 years after the first landing, Anaris was explored, mapped, investigated, but not colonized. Why move to a howling desert when there was plenty of room in the gracious valleys of Urus? But it was mined. The self-plundering eras of the 9th and early 10th millennia had left the loads of Urus empty, and as rocketry was perfected, it became cheaper to mine the moon than to extract needed metals from low-grade ores or seawater. In the Erasti year 9-738, a settlement was founded at the foot of the Ne Thera Mountains, where mercury was mined, in the old An's Hus. They called the place Anaris Town. It was not a town. There were no women. Men signed on for 2 or 3 years' duty as miners or technicians, then went home to the real world. The moon and its mines were under the jurisdiction of the Council of World Governments, but around in the moon's eastern hemisphere, the nation of Thu had a little secret, a rocket base and a settlement of gold miners with their wives and children. They really lived on the moon, but nobody knew it except their government. It was the collapse of that government in the year 771 that led to the proposal in the Council of World Governments of giving the moon to the International Society of Odonians, buying them off with a world before they fatally undermined the authority of law and national sovereignty on Urus. Anaris Town was evacuated, and from the midst of the turmoil in Thu, a couple of hasty final rockets were sent to pick up the gold miners. Not all of them chose to return. Some of them liked the howling desert. For over 20 years, the 12 ships granted to the Odonian settlers by the Council of World Governments went back and forth between the worlds, until the million souls who chose the new life had all been brought across the dry abyss. Then the port was closed to immigration and left open only to the freight ships of the trade agreement. By then, Anaris Town held 100,000 people and had been renamed Abani, which meant, in the new language of the new society, mind. Decentralization had been an essential element in Odo's plans for the society she did not live to see founded. She had no intention of trying to de-urbanize civilization, though she suggested that the natural limit to the size of a community lay in its dependence on its own immediate region for essential food and power. She intended that all communities be connected by communication and transportation networks, so that goods and ideas would get where they were wanted, and the administration of things might work with speed and ease, and no community should be cut off from change and interchange. But the network was not to be run from the top down. There was to be no controlling center, no capital, no establishment for the self-perpetuating machinery of bureaucracy, and the dominance drive of individuals seeking to become captains, bosses, chiefs of state. Her plans, however, had been based on the generous ground of Urus. On arid Anaris, the communities had to scatter widely in search of resources, and few of them could be self-supporting, no matter how they cut back their notions of what is needed for support. They cut back very hard, indeed, but to a minimum beneath which they would not go. They would not regress to pre-urban, pre-technological tribalism. They knew that their anarchism was the product of a very high civilization, of a complex, diversified culture, of a stable economy, and a highly industrialized technology that could maintain high production and rapid transportation of goods. However vast the distances separating settlements, they held to the ideal of complex organicism. They built the roads first, the houses second. The special resources and products of each region were interchanged continually with those of others in an intricate process of balance, that balance of diversity which is the characteristic of life, of natural and social ecology. But as they said in the analogic mode, you can't have a nervous system without at least a ganglion, and preferably a brain. There had to be a center. The computers that coordinated the administration of things, the division of labor, and the distribution of goods, and the central federatives of most of the work syndicates, were in Abenai, right from the start. And from the start, the settlers were aware that that unavoidable centralization was a lasting threat, to be countered by lasting vigilance. O child Anarchia, infinite promise, infinite carefulness, I listen, listen in the night, by the cradle deep as the night. Is it well with the child? Pioateon, who took the Pravic name Tober, wrote that in the 14th year of the settlement. The Odonians' first efforts to make their new language, their new world, into poetry, were stiff, ungainly, moving. Abenai, the mind and center of Anaris, was there now, ahead of the dirigible, on the great green plain. That brilliant, deep green of the fields was unmistakable, a color not native to Anaris. Only here, and on the warm shores of the Karen Sea, did the old world grains flourish. Elsewhere, the staple grain crops were ground holum and pale mene grass. When Shevik was 9, his afternoon schoolwork for several months had been caring for the ornamental plants in Wide Plains community, delicate exotics that had to be fed and sunned like babies. He had assisted an old man in the peaceful and exacting task, had liked him and liked the plants, and the dirt, and the work. When he saw the color of the plain of Abenai, he remembered the old man, and the smell of fish oil manure, and the color of the first leaf buds on small, bare branches, that clear, vigorous green. He saw in the distance among the vivid fields a long smudge of white, which broke into cubes like split salt as the dirigible came over. A cluster of dazzling flashes at the east edge of the city made him wink and see dark spots for a moment. The big parabolic mirrors that provided solar heat for Abenai's refineries. The dirigible came down at a cargo depot at the south end of town, and Shevik set off into the streets of the biggest city in the world. They were wide, clean streets. They were shadowless, for Abenai lay less than 30 degrees north of the equator, and all the buildings were low, except the strong, spare towers of the wind turbines. The sun shone white in a hard, dark, blue-violet sky. The air was clear and clean, without smoke or moisture. There was a vividness to things, a hardness of edge and corner, a clarity. Everything stood out separate, itself. The elements that made up Abenai were the same as in any other Odonian community, repeated many times, workshops, factories, domiciles, dormitories, learning centers, meeting halls, distributories, depots, refectories. The bigger buildings were most often grouped around open squares, giving the city a basic cellular texture. It was one sub-community or neighborhood after another. Heavy industry and food processing plants tended to cluster on the city's outskirts, and the cellular pattern was repeated in that related industries often stood side by side on a certain square or street. The first such that Shevik walked through was a series of squares, the textile district, full of holum fiber processing plants, spinning and weaving mills, dye factories, and cloth and clothing distributories. The center of each square was planted with a little forest of poles strung from top to bottom, with banners and pennants of all the colors of the dyer's art, proudly proclaiming the local industry. Most of the city's buildings were pretty much alike, plain, soundly built of stone or cast foam stone. Some of them looked very large to Shevik's eyes, but they were almost all of one story only, because of the frequency of earthquake. For the same reason, windows were small and of a tough silicon plastic that did not shatter. They were small, but there were a lot of them, for there was no artificial lighting provided from an hour before sunrise to an hour after sunset. No heat was furnished when the outside temperature went above 55 degrees Fahrenheit. It was not that Abinai was short of power, not with her wind turbines and the earth temperature differential generators used for heating, but the principle of organic economy was too essential to the functioning of the society not to affect ethics and aesthetics profoundly. "Excess is excrement," Odo wrote in the analogy. "Excrement retained in the body is a poison." Abinai was poisonless. A bare city, bright, the colors light and hard, the air pure. It was quiet. You could see it all, laid out as plain as spilt salt. Nothing was hidden. The squares, the austere streets, the low buildings, the unwalled workyards, were charged with vitality and activity. As Shevik walked, he was constantly aware of other people walking, working, talking, faces passing, voices calling, gossiping, singing, people alive, people doing things, people afoot. Workshops and factories fronted on squares or on their open yards, and their doors were open. He passed a glassworks, the workman dipping up a great molten blob as casually as a cook serves soup. Next to it was a busy yard where foam stone was cast for construction. The gang foreman, a big woman in a smock white with dust, was supervising the pouring of a cast with a loud and splendid flow of language. After that came a small wire factory, a district laundry, a luthier's where musical instruments were made and repaired, the district's small goods distributary, a theater, a tile works. The activity going on in each place was fascinating, and mostly out of full view. Children were around, some involved in the work with the adults, some underfoot making mud pies, some busy with games in the street, one sitting perched up on the roof of the learning center with her nose deep in a book. The wire maker had decorated the shop front with patterns of vines worked in painted wire, cheerful and ornate. The blast of steam and conversation from the wide-open doors of the laundry was overwhelming. No doors were locked, few shut. There were no disguises and no advertisements. It was all there, all the work, all the life of the city, open to the eye and to the hand. And every now and then, down Depot Street, a thing came careering by, clanging a bell, a vehicle crammed full of people, and with people festooned on stanchions all over the outside. Old women cursing heartily as it failed to slow down at their stop so they could scramble off. A little boy on a homemade tricycle pursuing it madly. Electric sparks showering blue from the overhead wires at crossings. As if that quiet, intense vitality of the streets built up every now and then to discharge point and leapt the gap with a crash and a blue crackle and the smell of ozone. These were the Abinai omnibuses, and as they passed, one felt like cheering. Depot Street ended in a large, airy place where five other streets rayed in to a triangular park of grass and trees. Most parks on Anaris were playgrounds of dirt or sand, with a stand of shrub and green holums. This one was different. Shevik crossed the trafficless pavement and entered the park, drawn to it because he had seen it often in pictures, and because he wanted to see alien trees, Erasti trees, from close up, to experience the greenness of those multitudinous leaves. The sun was setting. The sky was wide and clear, darkening to purple at the zenith, the dark of space showing through the thin atmosphere. He entered under the trees, alert, wary. Were they not wasteful, those crowding leaves? The tree holum got along very efficiently with spines and needles, and no excess of those. Wasn't all this extravagant foliage mere excess, excrement? Such trees couldn't thrive without a rich soil, constant watering, much care. He disapproved of their lavishness, their thriftlessness. He walked under them, among them. The alien grass was soft underfoot. It was like walking on living flesh. He shied back onto the path. The dark limbs of the trees reached out over his head, holding their many wide green hands above him. Awe came into him. He knew himself blessed, though he had not asked for blessing. Some ways before him, down the darkening path, a person sat reading on a stone bench. Shevik went forward slowly. He came to the bench and stood looking at the figure who sat with head bowed over the book in the green-gold dusk under the trees. It was a woman of 50 or 60, strangely dressed, her hair pulled back in a knot. Her left hand on her chin nearly hid the stern mouth. Her right held the papers on her knee. They were heavy, those papers. The cold hand on them was heavy. The light was dying fast, but she never looked up. She went on reading the proof sheets of the social organism. Shevik looked at Odo for a while, and then he sat down on the bench beside her. He had no concept of status at all, and there was plenty of room on the bench. He was moved by a pure impulse of companionship. He looked at the strong, sad profile, and at the hands, an old woman's hands. He looked up into the shadowy branches. For the first time in his life, he comprehended that Odo, whose face he had known since his infancy, whose ideas were central and abiding in his mind, and the mind of everyone he knew, that Odo had never set foot on Anaris, that she had lived and died and was buried in the shadow of green-leaved trees, in unimaginable cities, among people speaking unknown languages, on another world. Odo was an alien, an exile. The young man sat beside the statue in the twilight, one almost as quiet as the other. At last, realizing it was getting dark, he got up and made off into the streets again, asking directions to the Central Institute of the Sciences. It was not far. He got there not long after the lights went on. A registrar or vigil keeper was in the little office at the entrance, reading. He had to knock at the open door to get her attention. "Shevik," he said. It was customary to start conversation with a stranger by offering your name as a kind of handle for him to take hold of. There were not many other handles to offer. There was no rank, no terms of rank, no conventional respectful forms of address. "Cope Vaughn," the woman responded. "Weren't you expecting to get in yesterday?" "They've changed the cargo dirigible schedule. Is there an empty bed in one of the dorms?" "Number 46 is empty. Across the courtyard, the building to the left. There's a note for you here from Sabul. He says call on him in the morning at the physics office." "Thanks," said Shevik, and strode off across the broad paved courtyard, swinging his luggage, a winter coat, and a spare pair of boots in his hand. Lights were on in rooms all round the quadrangle. There was a murmur, a presence of people in the quietness. Something stirred in the clear, keen air of the city night, a sense of drama, of promise. Dinner hour was not over, and he made a quick detour by the Institute refectory to see if there was some spare food for a drop-in. He found that his name had already been put on the regular list, and he found the food excellent. There was even a dessert, stewed preserved fruit. Shevik loved sweets, and as he was one of the last diners and there was plenty of fruit left over, he took a second dish. He ate alone at a small table. At larger tables nearby, groups of young people were talking over their empty plates. He overheard discussions on the behavior of argon at very low temperatures, the behavior of a chemistry teacher at a colloquium, the putative curvatures of time. A couple of people glanced at him. They did not come speak to him, as people in a small community would speak to a stranger. Their glance was not unfriendly, perhaps a little challenging. He found room 46 in a long corridor of shut doors in the domicile. Evidently, they were all singles, and he wondered why the registrar had sent him there. Since he was 2 years old, he had always lived in dormitories, rooms of 4 to 10 beds. He knocked at the door of 46. Silence. He opened the door. The room was a small single, empty, dimly illuminated by the light in the corridor. He lighted the lamp. 2 chairs, a desk, a well-used slide rule, a few books, and, folded neatly on the bed platform, a hand-woven orange blanket. Somebody else lived here. The registrar had made a mistake. He shut the door. He opened it again to turn off the lamp. On the desk, under the lamp, was a note, scribbled on a torn-off scrap of paper. Shevik, Physics Office, Morning, 2-4-1-154. Sabul. He put his coat down on a chair, his boots on the floor. He stood a while and read the titles of the books, standard references in physics and mathematics, green bound, the circle of life stamped on the covers. He hung his coat in the closet and put his boots away. He drew the curtain of the closet carefully. He crossed the room to the door, 4 paces. He stood there hesitant a minute longer, and then, for the first time in his life, he closed the door of his own room. Sabul was a small, stocky, slovenly man of 40. His facial hair was darker and coarser than common, and thickened to a regular beard on his chin. He wore a heavy winter over tunic, and from the look of it, had worn it since last winter. The ends of the sleeves were black with grime. His manner was abrupt and grudging. He spoke in scraps, as he scribbled notes on scraps. He growled. "You've got to learn Eotic," he growled at Shevik. "Learn Eotic?" "I said learn Eotic." "What for?" "So you can read Erosti physics. Atro, Toe, Basque, those men. Nobody's translated it into Pravik. Nobody's likely to. 6 people, maybe, on Anaris, are capable of understanding it, in any language." "How can I learn Eotic?" "Grammar and a dictionary." Shevik stood his ground. "Where do I find them?" "Here," Sabul growled. He rummaged among the untidy shelves of small, green-bound books. His movements were brusque and irritable. He located 2 thick, unbound volumes on a bottom shelf and slapped them down on the desk. "Tell me when you're competent to read Atro and Eotic. Nothing I can do with you till then." "What kind of mathematics do these Erosti use?" "Nothing you can't handle." "Is anybody working here in chronotopology?" "Yes, Turret. You can consult him. You don't need his lecture course." "I planned to attend Gvarov's lectures." "What for?" "Her work in frequency and cycle." Sabul sat down and got up again. He was unbearably restless. Restless yet rigid. A wood rasp of a man. "Don't waste time. You're far beyond the old woman in sequency theory, and the other ideas she spouts are trash." "I'm interested in simultaneity principles." "Simultaneity? What kind of profiteering crap is Midas feeding you up there?" The physicist glared, the veins on his temples bulging under the coarse, short hair. "I organized a joint work course in it myself." "Grow up! Grow up! Time to grow up! You're here now. We're working on physics here, not religion. Drop the mysticism and grow up. How soon can you learn Eotic?" "It took me several years to learn Pravik," Shevik said. His mild irony passed Sabul by completely. "I did it in 10 decades, well enough to read Toe's introduction." "Oh, hell, you need a text to work on." "Might as well be that. Here, wait." He hunted through an overflowing drawer and finally achieved a book. A queer-looking book, bound in blue, without the circle of life on the cover. The title was stamped in gold letters and seemed to say, Poileia Aphioite, which didn't make any sense, and the shapes of some of the letters were unfamiliar. Shevik stared at it, took it from Sabul, but did not open it. He was holding it, the thing he had wanted to see, the alien artifact, the message from another world. He remembered the book Pilat had shown him, the Book of Numbers. "Come back when you can read that," Sabul growled. Shevik turned to go. Sabul raised his growl. Keep those books with you. They're not for general consumption. The young man paused, turned back, and said after a moment in his calm, rather diffident voice, I don't understand. Don't let anybody else read them. Shevik made no response. Sabul got up again and came close to him. Listen, you're now a member of the Central Institute of Sciences, a physics syndic, working with me, Sabul. You follow that? Privilege is responsibility, correct? I'm to acquire knowledge which I'm not to share, Shevik said after a brief pause, stating the sentence as if it were a proposition in logic. If you found a pack of explosive caps in the street, would you share them with every kid that went by? Those books are explosives. Now do you follow me? Yes. All right. Sabul turned away, scowling with what appeared to be an endemic, not a specific, rage. Shevik left, carrying the dynamite carefully, with revulsion and devouring curiosity. He set to work to learn Eotic. He worked alone in room 46, because of Sabul's warning, and because it came only too naturally to him to work alone. Since he was very young, he had known that in certain ways he was unlike anyone else he knew. For a child, the consciousness of such difference is very painful, since, having done nothing yet and being incapable of doing anything, he cannot justify it. The reliable and affectionate presence of adults who are also, in their own way, different, is the only reassurance such a child can have. And Shevik had not had it. His father had indeed been utterly reliable and affectionate. Whatever Shevik was and whatever he did, Palat approved and was loyal. But Palat had not had this curse of difference. He was like the others, like all the others to whom community came so easy. He loved Shevik, but he could not show him what freedom is, that recognition of each person's solitude, which alone transcends it. Shevik was, therefore, used to an inward isolation, buffered by all the daily casual contacts and exchanges of communal life, and by the companionship of a few friends. Here in Abani, he had no friends, and because he was not thrown into the dormitory situation, he made none. He was too conscious, at 20, of the peculiarities of his mind and character to be outgoing. He was withdrawn and aloof, and his fellow students, sensing that the aloofness was real, did not often try to approach him. The privacy of his room soon became dear to him. He savored his total independence. He left the room only for breakfast and dinner at the refectory, and a quick daily hike through the city streets to appease his muscles, which had always been used to exercise. Then, back to room 46 and the grammar of Eotic. Once every decade or two, he was called on for 10th-day rotational community labor. But the people he worked with were strangers, not close acquaintances as they would have been in a small community, so that these days of manual work made no psychological interruption to his isolation, or to his progress in Eotic. The grammar itself, being complex, illogical, and patterned, gave him pleasure. His learning went fast once he had built up the basic vocabulary, for he knew what he was reading, he knew the field and the terms, and whenever he got stuck, either his own intuition or a mathematical equation would show him where he had got to. They were not always places he had been before. Toe's introduction to temporal physics was no beginner's handbook. By the time he had worked his way to the middle of the book, Shevik was no longer reading Eotic. He was reading physics, and he understood why Sabul had had him read the Erasti physicists before he did anything else. They were far ahead of anything that had been done on Anaris for 20 or 30 years. The most brilliant insights of Sabul's own works on sequencing were, in fact, translations from the Eotic, unacknowledged. He plunged on through the other books Sabul doled out to him, the major works of contemporary Erosti physics. His life grew even more hermetic. He was not active in the student syndicate and did not attend the meetings of any other syndicates or federatives except the Lethargic Physics Federation. The meetings of such groups, the vehicles of both social action and sociability, were the framework of life in any small community. But here in the city, they seemed much less important. One was not necessary to them. There were always others ready to run things and doing it well enough. Except for 10th-day duties and the usual janitorial assignments in his domicile and the laboratories, Shevek's time was entirely on his own. He often omitted exercise and occasionally meals. However, he never missed the one course he was attending, Kvarub's lecture group on frequency and cycle. Kvarub was old enough that she often wandered and maundered. Attendance at her lectures was small and uneven. She soon picked out the thin boy with big ears as her one constant auditor. She began to lecture for him. The light, steady, intelligent eyes met hers, steadied her, woke her. She flashed to brilliance, regained the vision lost. She soared, and the other students in the room looked up, confused or startled, even scared, if they had the wits to be scared. Kvarub saw a much larger universe than most people were capable of seeing, and it made them blink. The light-eyed boy watched her steadily. In his face, she saw her joy. What she offered, what she had offered for a whole lifetime, what no one had ever shared with her. He took. He shared. He was her brother, across the gulf of 50 years, and her redemption. When they met in the physics offices or the refectory, sometimes they fell straight to talking physics. But at other times, Kvarub's energy was insufficient for that, and they found little to say, for the old woman was as shy as the young man. "You don't eat enough," she would tell him. He would smile, and his ears would get red. Neither knew what else to say. After he had been a half year at the Institute, Shevik gave Sabul a 3-page thesis entitled A Critique of Atro's Infinite Sequency Hypothesis. Sabul returned it to him after a decade, growling, "Translate it into Iotic." "I wrote it mostly in Iotic to start with," Shevik said. "Since I was using Atro's terminology, I'll copy out the original."
"What for?"
"What for? So that damned profiteer Atro can read it. There's a ship in on the 5th of next decade."
"A ship?"
"A freighter from Urus." Thus Shevik discovered that not only petroleum and mercury went back and forth between the sundered worlds, and not only books, such as the books he had been reading, but also letters. Letters! Letters to proprietarians, to subjects of governments founded on the inequity of power, to individuals who were inevitably exploited by and exploiters of others because they had consented to be elements in the state machine. Did such people actually exchange ideas with free people in a non-aggressive, voluntary manner? Could they really admit equality and participate in intellectual solidarity, or were they merely trying to dominate, to assert their power, to possess? The idea of actually exchanging letters with a proprietarian alarmed him, but it would be interesting to find out. So many such discoveries had been forced on him during his first half year in Abani that he had to realize that he had been, and possibly still was, very naive. Not an easy admission for an intelligent young man to make. The first, and still the least acceptable of these discoveries, was that he was supposed to learn Iotic, but keep his knowledge to himself. A situation so new to him, and morally so confusing, that he had not yet worked it out. Evidently, he did not exactly harm anybody by not sharing his knowledge with them. On the other hand, what conceivable harm could it do them to know that he knew Iotic, and that they could learn it too? Surely, freedom lay rather in openness than in secrecy, and freedom is always worth the risk. He could not see what the risk was, anyway. It occurred to him once that Sabel wanted to keep the new Erasti physics private, to own it as a property, a source of power over his colleagues on Anaris. But this idea was so counter to Shevik's habits of thinking that it had great difficulty getting itself clear in his mind. And when it did, he suppressed it at once, with contempt, as a genuinely disgusting thought. Then there was the private room, another moral thorn. As a child, if you slept alone in a single, it meant you had bothered the others in the dormitory until they wouldn't tolerate you. You had egoized. Solitude equated with disgrace. In adult terms, the principal referent for single rooms was a sexual one. Every domicile had a number of singles, and the couple that wanted to copulate used one of these free singles for a night, or a decade, or as long as they liked. A couple undertaking partnership took a double room. In a small town where no double was available, they often built one onto the end of a domicile, and long, low, straggling buildings might thus be created room by room, called partners' truck trains. Aside from sexual pairing, there was no reason for not sleeping in a dormitory. You could choose a small one or a large one, and if you didn't like your roommates, you could move to another dormitory. Everybody had the workshop, laboratory, studio, barn, or office that he needed for his work. One could be as private or as public as one chose in the baths. Sexual privacy was freely available and socially expected, and beyond that, privacy was not functional. It was excess, waste. The economy of Anaris would not support the building, maintenance, heating, lighting of individual houses and apartments. A person whose nature was genuinely unsociable had to get away from society and look after himself. He was completely free to do so. He could build himself a house wherever he liked, though if it spoiled a good view or a fertile bit of land, he might find himself under heavy pressure from his neighbors to move elsewhere. There were a good many solitaries and hermits on the fringes of the older Anaresti communities, pretending that they were not members of a social species. But for those who accepted the privilege and obligation of human solidarity, privacy was of value only where it served a function. Shevik's first reaction to being put in a private room, then, was half disapproval and half shame. Why had they stuck him in here? He soon found out why. It was the right kind of place for his kind of work. If ideas arrived at midnight, he could turn on the light and write them down. If they came at dawn, they weren't jostled out of his head by the conversation and commotion of four or five roommates getting up. If they didn't come at all, and he had to spend whole days sitting at his desk staring out the window, there was nobody behind his back to wonder why he was slacking. Privacy, in fact, was almost as desirable for physics as it was for sex. But all the same, was it necessary? There was always a dessert at the Institute refectory at dinner. Shevik enjoyed it very much, and when there were extras, he took them. And his conscience, his organic societal conscience, got indigestion. Didn't everybody at every refectory from Abani to Uttermost get the same, share and share alike? He had always been told so, and had always found it so. Of course there were local variations, regional specialities, shortages, surpluses, makeshifts in situations such as project camps, poor cooks, good cooks, in fact, and endless variety within the unchanging framework. But no cook was so talented that he could make a dessert without the makings. Most refectories served dessert once or twice a decade. Here it was served nightly. Why? Were the members of the Central Institute of the Sciences better than other people? Shevik did not ask these questions of anyone else. The social conscience, the opinion of others, was the most powerful moral force motivating the behavior of most Anaresti. But it was a little less powerful in him than in most of them. So many of his problems were of a kind other people did not understand that he had got used to working them out for himself, in silence. So he did with these problems, which were much harder for him, in some ways, than those of temporal physics. He asked no one's opinion. He stopped taking dessert at the refectory. He did not, however, move to a dormitory. He weighed the moral discomfort against the practical advantage and found the latter heavier. He worked better in the private room. The job was worth doing, and he was doing it well. It was centrally functional to his society. The responsibility justified the privilege. So, he worked. He lost weight. He walked light on the earth. Lack of physical labor, lack of variety of occupation, lack of social and sexual intercourse. None of these appeared to him as lacks, but as freedom. He was the free man. He could do what he wanted to do, when he wanted to do it, for as long as he wanted to do it. And he did. He worked. He work-played. He was sketching out notes for a series of hypotheses which led to a coherent theory of simultaneity. But that began to seem a petty goal. There was a much greater one, a unified theory of time to be reached, if he could just get to it. He felt that he was in a locked room in the middle of a great open country. It was all around him, if he could find the way out, the way clear. The intuition became an obsession. During that autumn and winter, he got more and more out of the habit of sleeping. A couple of hours a night, and a couple more sometime during the day, were enough for him, and such naps were not the kind of profound sleep he had always had before, but almost a waking on another level. They were so full of dreams. He dreamed vividly, and the dreams were part of his work. He saw time turn back upon itself, a river flowing upward to the spring. He held the contemporaneity of two moments in his left and right hands. As he moved them apart, he smiled to see the moments separate like dividing soap bubbles. He got up and scribbled down, without really waking, the mathematical formula that had been eluding him for days. He saw space shrink in upon him, like the walls of a collapsing sphere, driving in and in towards a central void, closing, closing. And he woke with a scream for help, locked in his throat, struggling in silence to escape from the knowledge of his own external emptiness. On a cold afternoon late in winter, he stopped in at the physics office on his way home from the library to see if there were any letters for him in the pickup box. He had no reason to expect any, since he had never written any of his friends at North Setting Regional. But he hadn't been feeling very well for a couple of days. He had disproved some of his own most beautiful hypotheses and brought himself, after half a year's hard work, right around to where he had started from. The phasic model was simply too vague to be useful. His throat felt sore. He wished there was a letter from somebody he knew, or maybe somebody in the physics office to say hello to, at least. But nobody was there, except Sabu. "Look here, Shevik." He looked at the book the older man held out, a thin book, bound in green, the circle of life on the cover. He took it and looked at the title page. "A Critique of Atro's Infinite Sequency Hypothesis." It was his essay, Atro's acknowledgement and defense, and his reply. It had all been translated or retranslated into Previc and printed by the PDC Presses in Abenai. There were two authors' names, Sabul and Shevik. Sabul craned his neck over the copy Shevik held and gloated. His growl became throaty and chuckling. "We've finished, Atro. Finished him, the damn profiteer. Now let them try to talk about puerile imprecision." Sabul had nursed 10 years' resentment against the Physics Review of AUN University, which had referred to his theoretical work as crippled by provincialism and the puerile imprecision with which Adonian dogma infects every area of thought. They'll see who's provincial now, he said, grinning. In nearly a year's acquaintance, Shevek could not recall having seen him smile. Shevek sat down across the room, clearing a pile of papers off a bench to do so. The physics office was, of course, communal. But Sabol kept this back room of the two littered with materials he was using, so that there never seemed to be quite room for anyone else. Shevek looked down at the book he still held, then out the window. He felt and looked rather ill. He also looked tense, but with Sabol, he had never been shy or awkward, as he often was with people whom he would have liked to know. I didn't know you were translating it, he said. Translated it, edited it, polished some of the rougher spots, filled in transitions you'd left out, and so forth. Couple of decades' work. You should be proud of it. Your ideas, to a large extent, form the groundwork of the finished book. It consisted entirely of Shevik's and Atro's ideas. Yes, Shevek said. He looked down at his hands. Presently he said, I'd like to publish the paper I wrote this quarter on reversibility. It ought to go to Atro. It would interest him. He's still hung up on causation. Publish it? Where? In Eotic. I meant on Urus. Send it to Atro, like this last one, and he'll put it in one of the journals there. You can't give them a work to publish that hasn't been printed here. But that's what we did with this one. All this, except my rebuttal, came out in the AUN review, before this came out here. I couldn't prevent that. But why do you think I hurried this into print? You don't think everybody in PDC approves of our trading ideas with Urus like this, do you? Defense insists that every word that leaves here on those freighters be passed by a PDC-approved expert. And on top of that, do you think all the provincial physicists who don't get in on this pipeline to Urus don't begrudge our using it? Think they aren't envious? There are people lying in wait for us to make a false step. If we're ever caught doing it, we'll lose that mail slot on the Erasti freighters. You see the picture now? How did the Institute get that mail slot in the first place? Pegver's election to the PDC 10 years ago. Pegver had been a physicist of moderate distinction. I've trod damned carefully to keep it ever since, see? Shevek nodded. In any case, Atro doesn't want to read that stuff of yours. I looked that paper over and gave it back to you decades ago. When are you going to stop wasting time on these reactionary theories Gvarub clings to? Can't you see she's wasted her whole life on them? If you keep at it, you're going to make a fool of yourself. Which, of course, is your inalienable right, but you're not going to make a fool of me. What if I submit the paper for publication here, in Previc, then? Waste of time. Shevek absorbed this with a slight nod. He got up, lanky and angular, and stood a moment, remote among his thoughts. The winter light lay harsh on his hair, which he now wore pulled back in a queue, and his still face. He came to the desk and took a copy off the little stock of new books. I'd like to send one of these to Midas, he said. Take all you want. Listen, if you think you know what you're doing better than I do, then submit that paper to the press. You don't need permission. This isn't some kind of hierarchy, you know? I can't stop you. All I can do is give you my advice. You're the press syndicate's consultant on manuscripts in physics, Shevek said. I thought I'd save time for everyone by asking you now. His gentleness was uncompromising, because he would not compete for dominance. He was indomitable. Save time? What do you mean? Sabul growled, but Sabul was also an Odonian. He writhed as if physically tormented by his own hypocrisy, turned away from Shevek, turned back to him, and said spitefully, his voice thick with anger, Go ahead. Submit the damn thing. I'll declare myself incompetent to give counsel on it. I'll tell them to consult Gvarub. She's the simultaneity expert, not I, the mystical Gagaist.
The universe is a giant harp string oscillating in and out of existence. What note does it play, by the way? Passages from the numerical harmonies, I suppose? The fact is that I am incompetent. In other words, unwilling to counsel PDC or the press on intellectual excrement.
The work I've done for you, Shevik said, is part of the work I've done following Guvarab's ideas in simultaneity. If you want one, you'll have to stand the other. Grain grows best in shit, as we say in North Setting. He stood for a moment, and getting no verbal reply from Sabu, said goodbye and left. He knew he had won a battle, and easily, without apparent violence. But violence had been done. As Midas had predicted, he was Sabul's man. Sabul had ceased to be a functioning physicist years ago. His high reputation was built on expropriations from other minds. Shevik was to do the thinking, and Sabul would take the credit. Obviously, an ethically intolerable situation, which Shevik would denounce and relinquish. Only he would not. He needed Sabul. He wanted to publish what he wrote and to send it to the men who could understand it. The Erasti physicists. He needed their ideas, their criticism, their collaboration. So they had bargained, he and Sabu, bargained like profiteers. It had not been a battle, but a sale. You give me this and I'll give you that. Refuse me and I'll refuse you. Sold? Sold. Shevik's career, like the existence of his society, depended on the continuance of a fundamental, unadmitted profit contract. Not a relationship of mutual aid and solidarity, but an exploitative relationship. Not organic, but mechanical. Can true function arise from basic dysfunction? But all I want to do is get the job done, Shevik pleaded in his mind as he walked across the mall towards the domicile quadrangle in the gray, windy afternoon. It's my duty. It's my joy. It's the purpose of my whole life. The man I have to work with is competitive, a dominance seeker, a profiteer, but I can't change that. If I want to work, I have to work with him. He thought about Midas and her warning. He thought about the North Setting Institute and the party the night before he left. It seemed very long ago now, and so childishly peaceful and secure that he could have wept in nostalgia. As he passed under the porch of the Life Sciences building, a girl passing looked sidelong at him, and he thought that she looked like that girl, what was her name? The one with short hair, who had eaten so many fried cakes the night of the party. He stopped and turned, but the girl was gone around the corner. Anyhow, she had had long hair. Gone. Gone. Everything gone. He came out from the shelter of the porch into the wind. There was a fine rain on the wind, sparse. Rain was sparse when it fell at all. This was a dry world, dry, pale, inimical. Inimical! Shevik said out loud in Eotic. He had never heard the language spoken. It sounded very strange. The rain stung his face like thrown gravel. It was an inimical rain. His sore throat had been joined by a terrific headache, of which he had only just become aware. He got to room 46 and lay down on the bed platform, which seemed to be much farther down than usual. He shook and could not stop shaking. He pulled the orange blanket up around him and huddled up, trying to sleep, but he could not stop shaking, because he was under constant atomic bombardment from all sides, increasing as the temperature increased. He had never been ill, and never known any physical discomfort worse than tiredness. Having no idea what a high fever was like, he thought, during the lucid intervals of that long night, that he was going insane. Fear of madness drove him to seek help when day came. He was too frightened of himself to ask help from his neighbors on the corridor. He had heard himself raving in the night. He dragged himself to the local clinic, 8 blocks away, the cold streets bright with sunrise spinning solemnly about him. At the clinic, they diagnosed his insanity as a light pneumonia and told him to go to bed in Ward 2. He protested. The aide accused him of egoizing and explained that if he went home, a physician would have to go to the trouble of calling on him there and arranging private care for him. He went to bed in Ward 2. All the other people in the ward were old. An aide came and offered him a glass of water and a pill. "What is it?" Shevik asked suspiciously. His teeth were chattering again.
"Antipyretic."
"What's that?"
"Bring down the fever."
"I don't need it." The aide shrugged.
"All right,"
she said and went on. Most young Anoresti felt that it was shameful to be ill, a result of their society's very successful prophylaxis, and also perhaps a confusion arising from the analogic use of the words healthy and sick. They felt illness to be a crime, if an involuntary one, to yield to the criminal impulse, to pander to it by taking pain relievers, was immoral. They fought shy of pills and shots. As middle age and old age came on, most of them changed their view. The pain got worse than the shame. The aide gave the old men in Ward 2 their medicine, and they joked with her. Shevik watched with dull incomprehension. Later on, there was a doctor with an injection needle. "I don't want it," Shevik said. "Stop egoizing," the doctor said. "Roll over." Shevik obeyed. Later on, there was a woman who held a cup of water for him, but he shook so much that the water was spilt, wetting the blanket. "Let me alone," he said. "Who are you?" She told him, but he did not understand. He told her to go away. He felt very well. Then he explained to her why the cyclic hypothesis, though unproductive in itself, was essential to his approach to a possible theory of simultaneity, a cornerstone. He spoke partly in his own language and partly in Aeotic, and wrote the formulas and equations on a slate with a piece of chalk so that she and the rest of the group would understand, as he was afraid they would misunderstand about the cornerstone. She touched his face and tied his hair back for him. Her hands were cool. He had never felt anything pleasanter in all his life than the touch of her hands. He reached out for her hand. She was not there. She had gone. A long time later, he was awake. He could breathe. He was perfectly well. Everything was all right. He felt disinclined to move. To move would disturb the perfect, stable moment, the balance of the world. The winter light along the ceiling was beautiful beyond expression. He lay and watched it. The old men down the ward were laughing together, old, husky, cackling laughs, a beautiful sound. The woman came in and sat down by his cot. He looked at her and smiled.
"How do you feel?"
"Newborn. Who are you?" She also smiled.
"The mother."
"Rebirth. But I'm supposed to get a new body, not the same old one." "What on earth are you talking about?" "Nothing on earth. On Urus, rebirth is part of their religion."
"You're still lightheaded."
She touched his forehead.
"No fever."
Her voice in saying those two words touched and struck something very deep in Shevik's being, a dark place, a place walled in, where it reverberated back and back in the darkness. He looked at the woman and said with terror,
"You are Rulak."
"I told you I was several times." She maintained an expression of unconcern, even of humor. There was no question of Shevik's maintaining anything. He had no strength to move, but he shrank away from her in unconcealed fear, as if she were not his mother, but his death. If she noticed this weak movement, she gave no sign. She was a handsome woman, dark, with fine and well-proportioned features, showing no lines of age, though she must be over 40. Everything about her person was harmonious and controlled. Her voice was low,
pleasant in timbre. "I didn't know you were here in Abenai," she said, "or where you were, or even whether you were. I was in the press depot looking through new publications, picking things up for the engineering library, and I saw a book by Sabul and Shevik. Sabul I knew, of course. But who's Shevik? Why does it sound so familiar?" I didn't arrive at it for a minute or more. Strange, isn't it? But it didn't seem reasonable. The Shevik I knew would be only 20, not likely to be co-authoring treatises in metacosmology with Sabul. But any other Shevik would have to be even younger than 20. So I came to see. A boy in the domicile said you were here. This is a shockingly understaffed clinic. I don't understand why the syndics don't request some more postings from the Medical Federation, or else cut down the number of admissions. Some of these aides and doctors are working 8 hours a day. Of course there are people in the medical arts who actually want that, the self-sacrifice impulse. Unfortunately, it doesn't lead to maximum efficiency. It was strange to find you. I would never have known you. Are you and Palat in touch? How is he?
He's dead.
Ah. There was no pretense of shock or grief in Rulag's voice, only a kind of dreary accustomedness, a bleak note. Shevik was moved by it, enabled to see her for a moment as a person. How long ago did he die?
8 years.
He couldn't have been more than 35.
There was an earthquake in Wide Plains. We'd been living there about 5 years. He was construction engineer for the community. The quake damaged the learning center. He was with the others trying to get out some of the children who were trapped inside. There was a second quake, and the whole thing went down. There were 32 people killed.
Were you there?
I'd gone to start training at the Regional Institute about 10 days before the quake.
She mused, her face smooth and still. Poor Palat. Somehow, it's like him to have died with others, a statistic, one of 32.
The statistics would have been higher if he hadn't gone into the building, Shevik said.
She looked at him then. Her gaze did not show what emotion she felt or did not feel. What she said might be spontaneous or deliberate. There was no way to tell. You were fond of Palat.
He did not answer.
You don't look like him. In fact, you look like me, except in coloring. I thought you'd look like Palat. I assumed it. It's strange how one's imagination makes these assumptions. He stayed with you then? Shevik nodded. He was lucky.
She did not sigh, but a suppressed sigh was in her voice.
So was I.
There was a pause. She smiled faintly.
Yes, I could have kept in touch with you. Do you hold it against me, my not having done so?
Hold it against you? I never knew you.
You did. Palat and I kept you with us in the domicile, even after you were weaned. We both wanted to. Those first years are when the individual contact is essential. The psychologists have proved it conclusively. Full socialization can be developed only from that affectional beginning. I was willing to continue the partnership. I tried to have Palat posted here to Abenai. There never was an opening in his line of work, and he wouldn't come without a posting. He had a stubborn streak. At first, he wrote sometimes to tell me how you were. Then he stopped writing.
It doesn't matter, the young man said. His face thin from illness was covered with very fine drops of sweat, making his cheeks and forehead look silvery, as if oiled.
There was silence again, and Rulag said in her controlled, pleasant voice, well, yes, it mattered, and it still matters. But Palat was the one to stay with you and see you through your integrative years. He was supportive,
He was parental, as I am not. The work comes first with me. It has always come first. Still, I'm glad you're here now, Shevik. Perhaps I can be of some use to you now. I know Abinai is a forbidding place at first. One feels lost, isolated, lacking the simple solidarity the little towns have. I know interesting people whom you might like to meet, and people who might be useful to you. I know Sebul. I have some notion of what you may have come up against with him, and with the whole institute. They play dominance games there. It takes some experience to know how to outplay them. In any case, I'm glad you're here. It gives me a pleasure I never looked for, a kind of joy. I read your book. It is yours, isn't it? Why else would Sebul be co-publishing with a 20-year-old student? The subject's beyond me. I'm only an engineer. I confess to being proud of you. That's strange, isn't it? Unreasonable. Propertarian, even. As if you were something that belonged to me. But as one gets older, one needs certain reassurances that aren't always entirely reasonable in order to go on at all. He saw her loneliness. He saw her pain and resented it. It threatened him. It threatened his father's loyalty, that clear, constant love in which his life had taken root. What right had she, who had left Palat in need, to come in her need to Palat's son? He had nothing, nothing to give her or anyone. It might have been better, he said, if you'd gone on thinking of me as a statistic, too. Ah, she said, the soft, habitual, desolate response. She looked away from him. The old men down at the end of the ward were admiring her, nudging each other. I suppose, she said, that I was trying to make a claim on you. But I thought in terms of your making a claim on me, if you wanted to. He said nothing. We aren't, except biologically, mother and son, of course. She had regained her faint smile. You don't remember me, and the baby I remember isn't this man of 20. All that is time past, irrelevant. But we are brother and sister, here and now. Which is what really matters, isn't it? I don't know. She sat without speaking for a minute, then stood up. You need to rest. You were quite ill the first time I came. They say you'll be quite all right now. I don't suppose I'll be back. He did not speak. She said, "Goodbye, Shevik," and turned from him as she spoke. He had either a glimpse or a nightmare imagination of her face changing drastically as she spoke, breaking down, going all to pieces. It must have been imagination. She walked out of the ward with the graceful, measured gait of a handsome woman, and he saw her stop and speak, smiling, to the aide out in the hall. He gave way to the fear that had come with her, the sense of the breaking of promises, the incoherence of time. He broke. He began to cry, trying to hide his face in the shelter of his arms, for he could not find the strength to turn over. One of the old men, the sick old men, came and sat on the side of the cot and patted his shoulder. "It's all right, brother. It'll be all right, little brother," he muttered. Shevik heard him and felt his touch, but took no comfort in it. Even from the brother there is no comfort in the bad hour, in the dark, at the foot of the wall.